Hey, this is Sarah Watkins, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to another edition of Walking the Floor. Brought to you this week, as always, by Floyd's 99 Barbershops. Now I challenge you, the listener, to go get your damn haircut at Floyd's 99 Barbershops, located everywhere. All right, listeners, this is a really special show today because Sarah Watkins breaks the chain of white male dominance that has held its iron grip over Walking the Floor for all these years. Finally, there's a woman that's brave enough to come over to Mar Vista, to my studio, and talk to me about, you know, music and music stuff. We have been liberated, people. Anyway, it's great. We'll get to that in a minute. Right now, I'm out in Nashville. Because I'm starting a record out here next week. So I'm going to be out here for a few weeks. So I'll let you know what happens with that. I'm very, very excited to be recording out here. I think it's going to be great. And, you know, when it's done, I might just, maybe I'll debut a track on this show. You know, we'll do something like that. But first, ladies and gentlemen, are you looking to buy a new or used vehicle? What do you know about TrueCar? Did you know that TrueCar users save an average of $3,279 off MSRP? Or that there are over 500,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide? You know, whether you're looking to buy new or used, you can get upfront pricing information, discounts off the list price for used cars, and you know, just a better overall buying experience through the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. You'll see what other people paid for the car you want, so you can know what a fair price is and feel confident. And with TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing, so you enjoy a quick, easy buying experience. And of course, you know, using the TrueCar website, TrueCar app, you easily find the new or used car you want. Plus, you get a guaranteed savings certificate from a TrueCar certified dealer. And, you know, your savings off of MSRP will be honored at the over 11,000 TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar.com or download the TrueCar app and enjoy yourself a better car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states. Okay, now that we've done that, let's talk to Sarah Watkins.
Every step's been shown to you, like all those years of school. What they said is what you say, what they saw is what you see.
Child phenom Sarah Watkins was a founding member of the bluegrass band Nickel Creek at the ripe old age of 8 years old. And she's been making records and touring the world ever since. She recently released her third solo record, titled Young in All the Wrong Ways. I think Sarah Watkins is young in all the right ways, and she has an impressive resume to prove it. She was kind enough to stop by my studio over in Mar Vista and talk to me about it, and a whole lot more. This is Sarah Watkins on Walking the Floor.
Talking quickly doesn't leave much time for questioning.
I have to tell you, this is a special interview for me because although I've been doing this podcast for a few years, you are the first female guest I have ever had, and it's not for lack of trying.
Really?
We have tried. I had an interview scheduled not too long ago with Margot Price, and wow, they wound up getting canceled at the last minute, stuff like that.
Aww.
We've reached out to so many different people, and you're this, you're breaking the chain of, you know, male domination of this podcast.
Well, I'm happy to be here, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah,
I cool. Definitely saw a lot of male faces on,
yeah,
the,
yeah, yeah,
on the old past playlist.
It's funny, because just a couple days ago, I've been like, it's been gnawing at the back of my mind. I'm like, somebody's going to figure this out, that we've only had like a string of white men basically this whole time. We're just going to start to get flack for it. And finally, a couple days ago, I saw somebody on Twitter was like, how come there's no women on your show?
Right.
And I actually answered back right away. I was like, Sarah Watkins is coming.
I saw that. Yeah. I saw that. Like, I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah. You know, when I think of you, and I, you know, I don't know you personally, it's the first time I ever met you, but I associate you in my mind with the Largo music scene, mm-hmm. Which is just littered with just incredible, talented musicians. I mean, yeah. It's a like, really high level of musicianship in that world. So I'm wondering, how did you find yourself there?
It's crazy.
At the center of that?
Flanagan, who runs the place, just opened his arms to us. My brother and I grew up in Vista, California. It's like 2 hours south of here. And we started going to Largo once we went to see our friend Glenn Phillips, who used to be in a band called
also
Toad
a Santa Barbara, Santa yeah. Barbara native. My Santa band Barbara, in high yeah. school actually played with his band.
Oh, really?
With Toad. Yeah,
awesome.
Way back. I still have the first Toad record on cassette tape.
Nice.
Self-release.
Nice.
Yeah.
He's a great songwriter and a great singer, and Toad was we really enjoyed, particularly the Fear and Coil record that they put out. And we saw that he was playing Largo, and Sean wanted to get him to sing on one of his records, and so Glenn's like, sure, come on up, and he's like, you should sing a couple songs with us, and Chris Thiele, our Nickel Creek bandmate, was staying with us at the time. We all went up to see him, and we just knew a bunch of Toad songs, and so Glenn just let us sit in with like all these songs. It was super fun. And then Flanagan, the owner, invited us to see John Bryan a couple times. And, you know, we ended up...
For people listening that don't know John Bryan, like just one of the most mind-blowing guitar players, musicians in general.
Yeah, and at the time he had a Friday night every week. Every Friday night he'd play. And, you know, it said the show started at 9. He didn't variably go up on like at 11 p.m.
Didn't he actually live above Largo?
For a few years after it moved to the Cornet, yeah.
Okay.
Or for a while, anyway.
Where was it before?
At a little club on Fairfax.
Okay.
Largo, right across from Cantor's Deli.
Right.
And that's where I started going to it around 2000 or so. And
were all those folks there and part of that scene?
Like
I think of like
you know,
Benmont Tench.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know.
So that's how we met Benmont Tench, Greg Lease, Grantley Phillips, Sam Phillips, and, you know, all these people. A huge, like, tons of comedy that is still very, like, that's a big part of what Largo still does. Mm. I got to see, you know, Jackson Brown, that's how I know, like, there's so many musical friends that I know who are now personal friends. Fiona Apple, all these people who were part of that family. And Flanagan invited my brother Sean and I to do a show called the Watkins Family Hour. Flanagan said, he's like, you guys should do a show here. We'll call it the Watkins Family Hour. You should just, you know, bring people down, play songs. It'll be great. I don't care if 17 people come. You should do it. We'll do it once a month. And it was that simple. And then we're like, that sounds great. At the time, we were touring 3 weeks. We'd get a week off. We'd just do a show on our week off. And it became like our home residency gig that we could just do whatever songs we wanted to do, no pressure. And it was like a lifeline for a long time musically because it really gave us an opportunity to do things you wouldn't ever do in your day job, you know?
And are all the folks kind of around that scene playing with each other and playing in each other's various projects? Because that's what it sort of appears. It looks like this incredibly fertile music world over there.
Yeah, that club, like if you were part of that, the Largo family, you could come in the back door, which would meant you walked through the kitchen and you'd walk through these kitchen doors. And from the stage, which was a corner stage, very short room, you could see the silhouettes of people who were standing right next to between the soundboard and the bar. There's like a little alley and you could see these little silhouettes and you could see like John Bryan in his hat and or Benmont or somebody or, you know, like... I met Jim Keltner on stage, the great drummer on stage at Largo, as well as a lot of other people. And you could see these people. And the kind of understanding was like, if you saw them, you could just say, be like, hey, you know, whatever. Like, you know.
Let's play a tune.
Benmont Tench, come on up and play piano on something. And,
yeah.
Come on up. It's a really magical place. I didn't have a place like that before.
I mean, how did the thing develop there where it's so quiet? I have played Largo once, and I admittedly am not good at the sort of a man and his acoustic guitar thing, which is what I was doing then. I was not up there with a band. I was just me and an acoustic.
It's a whole
and
different.
It was the most terrifying gig I have ever played in my life. I'm so not used to that kind of silence.
Attentiveness, yeah.
How did that develop? And are you comfortable with that? I mean, yeah. I assume you must be now.
I am comfortable with it because I didn't really grow up playing rock gigs. I grew up playing to fairly attentive audiences.
Right.
And the thing at the old place that at Fairfax, you know, people were right up against the stage. It was like a tiny little place, 130 people, sold out with standing room. Mm. And it was dinner. And there was a little bit of rapport from the audience with this great, like, the audiences were expected, were kind of trained by Flanny and by the people who play there to just expect bands to, like, try out a song. You know, right. You have a verse and a chorus, try it out. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know, see, just that's how you develop. And comedians too, same kind of thing, very experimentally friendly. And before the show, it's a very straightforward announcement. Like when you're walking in the door, probably again before the show starts, like turn off your phones, don't talk. You talk, you can leave, like then come back. But you know, that's not what this is for.
Right.
And that's not really, a lot of audiences, a lot of people don't want to experience that going to shows, and that's cool. But if you do want to have that kind of listening experience, Largo's a good place to get it.
Let's talk about your new album that's about to come out.
Great.
When does it come out?
July 1st.
I read that you, when you started making the record, you didn't have a label. And I'm wondering if that affected, you know, your songwriting and the choices you made recording the record.
I think it did, mostly just in my brain, but it didn't. I've been lucky enough to not feel the pressure of a label's expectations going into records before. Like generally, I grew up in Nickel Creek, which is we were on Sugar Hill Records. They were very hands off creatively, which was a luxury. And my first two records too, I just kind of made the thing, and they're like, that sounds great, keep going. This time, I was free of a label, and I was in between management. Mm. And I think more than anything, it was just me. I was in the middle of kind of changing courses, or just kind of, do you have these things, like every like 5 or 10 years or so, something just kind of happens, you just kind of make an evaluation of where you are, different areas of your life. Sometimes it's like a slight pivot adjustment, and sometimes it's like kind of some big changes, mm-hmm. and you just have to make some decisions that maybe go a little bit, pry a little bit into your weed, a little bit into your life. And it was one of those kinds of couple of year period. And it was nice to be free of, and it was also kind of stressful to be free of some business ties. Mm. But I think it ended up being really good and fitting for the songs that I ended up writing.
I saw that a thing that was like a pre-order thing through Pledge Music, and then I also saw that you're on New West,
mm-hmm.
and it's in the Pledge Music thing. I wasn't familiar with what that was, but it looked like one of those, like a Kickstarter where you buy the bundle, like a self-release, but you're on a label. So I'm wondering
it's more like a, they're using the platform for, to promote pre-releasing. So it's it's like a,
I didn't know if this was a continued evolution of the modern day record business that I'm just not hip to yet.
It could be, but it's not. No, I was under the same impression. They have done Kickstarter stuff in the past, but they're also being used very commonly now for any special package thing that happens. And so pre-orders are really helpful for bands these days.
Yeah, sure.
And it's a way to get special packages of incentivizing incentive.
Yeah.
Those kinds of things.
When you make a solo record, as opposed to like working with Nickel Creek or one of the various bands or projects you've been in, how do you do it? Do you assemble a band and then that's like your core band that you record with, or do you bring in a bunch of different people just in layer things?
I've done it different ways. The first record I did, with John Paul Jones, who you know.
Oh,
he produced my first record. He's a mandolin player.
Right.
And a very sweet guy. And we did half of it in L.A. and half in Nashville, largely using musicians who were just kind of around, people I knew at Largo in L.A. And then in Nashville, a bunch of other friends. And it was pretty straightforward, not a ton of intricate arrangement parts being made. It was very performance-based. And the second record, Blake Mills produced, and it was a little bit more, we had a foundation with he, my brother Sean played guitar, and Blake did stuff, and I sang. And then we sort of, after that foundation was laid, we overdubbed a lot and put on parts and strings and things.
You did that even before drums.
Drums were a lot of times there'd be like some kind of performed drum thing happening.
Oh, okay.
If we used a click, the drums were just kind of like some kind of rumbly thing was being performed along with that.
Right.
Kind of loping, not necessarily strict metronomic click kind of thing. But right. So there'd be like a human performance we'd be playing too. The guitars and stuff, and then we build up. But there's a lot of stuff on that record that doesn't really have drums.
Right, sure.
And then this record was for the most part, it was a set band, and the parts that there were a lot of them were composed into the arrangement of the song that I would just play for the guys in the room, and then they'd kind of, you know, find their own way into it, and we'd tweak it a little bit and zone in on the things, hone in on the things that were, you know, what you wanted to build on.
Are you comfortable in that role as band leader? Like, are you orchestrating people's parts, or is it more of like assemble a bunch of musicians you love and just let them kind of do their thing?
It was a lot of music. I definitely wasn't dictating everything to everybody. These are real pros who have a lot to bring, and that was part of the reason we got them. But Gabe Witcher, who produced it, was really helpful in it and as well. And then I contributed to that stuff, and I got to sing.
Now's your
them,
time to take credit for
really
everything.
Fun.
I told John Bryan exactly what to play.
Yeah. No, John Bryan. Do it the way I told
That's
you to
right.
do it.
I'm the boss.
Yeah. No, John did come down to the studio. He was hanging out a lot. I think he was putting off something else he didn't want to do. And so he brought down a bunch of guitars we got to play, use for the session. He was very generous. And it was really, really positive, really fun recording experience. Couple weeks down at United. It was great. And getting to sing like Jay Bellrose was playing drums, and so I'd sing with them, and then after we got the take, you know, I'd sing a few more passes and we'd move on.
How did you wind up performing at such a young age? I mean, how did you start so young? Why did that happen?
My parents had my brother in piano lessons, and we became friends with this piano teacher, and she's like,
"Your brother's older than you?"
My brother's 4 years older. Yeah, okay. Sean Watkins, great guitar player. He was taking piano lessons at the time, and she sent us to this pizza parlor where her son was playing in a bluegrass band called Bluegrass Etc. And these guys, his name was John Moore. Dennis Kaplinger was the fiddle player and banjo player most nights. Byron Berlin also went down. He was a great fiddle player from Oklahoma. Lived in LA for a long time, and these guys would play every Saturday night from like 7 to 10 or something, and I was really little, and it was this really tight community of bluegrass fans, and the line between band and audience in bluegrass can be very, very gray. And you know, these guys are playing like 3-4 sets a night. They get a bunch of guys or people from the audience to play. So there's like, you know, Ken Owens was a spoon player. This guy from Wales, you know, and he'd come up and play spoons on like a song or two, you know. Some other guy would go up and sing one of three songs that he sang, and we became friends with the band, and I requested Long Black Veil when I was 4.
And how did you know that music when you were that young?
Well,
that's like
just
not the music
because
that
I know it's just
children tend to grab it. It's very adult music.
Well, it's
you
just
know?
What I knew.
I mean, was listening to McDonald's records when I was that age.
I think I probably was too, but seeing it live really made an impression. And I think one of the things that appealed to me so much about performing non-classical music was because I play violin. That could have been the other way that I go, but it just seemed like a thing that you do. It seemed normal. It was like, you know, you hang out with your friends and then next thing you know, they're playing a song and you can sing it too. And it just seemed like part of life. And I loved it so much. That community is really what I love about it. So I requested them to sing Long Black Veil. And John Moore said, well, we'll do it, but you need to sing it. And I said, I only know the chorus. And he said, that's great. So I'd go up and sing the chorus. And then, you know, he wanted to get me to sing songs I learned in kindergarten. And I remember being like, what else do you know? You sing anymore? I said, well, I know a song from school, but you don't know it. And he's like, try me. And so I sang this song that has, you know, three chords. And I was amazed. I remember being like, oh, my gosh, how did you do that? How did you just play a song with a song with a... How did you play along with a song you'd never heard? And I was amazed. And I know. Eventually, I started taking fiddle lessons from the fiddle player, and they were all. We were very lucky because they were great players and really, really excellent teachers as well.
I mean, is there a big bluegrass scene on the West Coast?
No, I mean there. It comes up in little pockets.
Right.
Where are those flare ups? There's a good Bay Area scene. At the time, there was a big scene, or not a big scene, but a bluegrass, et cetera, was sort of the magnet of anybody who loved that kind of thing in Southern California. There were festivals. There was a festival called Follows Camp that a bunch of us kids used to go to and enter contests. There was a festival, Topanga, Julian, and Lake Henshaw down in San Diego, Calico Ghost Town. There were a bunch of festivals out in the desert because land's cheap. So a lot of times it'd just be like a bunch of people in lawn chairs sitting in the middle of a rodeo arena, you know, in the dirt and having a great time inexplicably. It was a funny thing, but I really loved growing up that way.
So
that's I know Sean and Chris, that's Tentacle Creek started.
And that was your first band, right?
I mean,
weren't you like eight or something when they started? So having started so young, did you go through a phase later on, like, you know, junior high and high school and those ages when you were listening to different kinds of music and playing in other bands, different kinds of, you know, different musical styles and genres and that sort of thing?
I was pretty oblivious to most pop culture things for a lot longer than most kids, I think.
I just think about the stretch between, in my own personal music taste, that like music that I would have been listening to at 8 versus 16.
Totally.
It's a pretty wide.
Sean, my older brother, was kind of my source for music that wasn't right in front of me. We, as a family, we listened to like 80s country stuff, you know, like George Jones
and
Randy Travis,
right,
and like
the Dwight, Willis,
the Circle
sort of
being broken, and Dwight Yoakam, and you know, Clint and all that stuff, and the Trio record, Dolly Parton, Linda Ronstadt, and Emmylou Harris, lots of Linda Ronstadt and Emmylou Harris, and all that stuff. So there's a big country phase for me as well.
Sure.
But then, like, when my brother brought home like Weezer and stuff like that, then that sort of blew open the gates. And Toe the Wet Sprocket actually was a really good kind of jumping off point, because it was lyrics that we hadn't really heard before, really interesting melodies, sung well, it was familiar enough sounding that it really gave us something to jump into. And then from there, we became a little bit more normal.
Did you guys get flack from bluegrass purist type people? I imagine
in
that world,
sure,
there might be a section of fans that are like, you just play the Ralph Stanley songs and that's it, you know?
Yeah, like I'm sure you talk to people from the countryside of things too, who have experienced that kind of thing, where it's there's this, what people want you to do, and then there's what people want you to do, and then there's also a good group of people who just kind of are fine with you doing what you want to do. And for us, I think it's kind of the opposite of country, though, because like the mainstream is where the more like lucrative stuff is, and your off-brand is people kind of sticking to their roots. And for bluegrass, you know, the on-brand traditional stuff is, you know, can only grow so much, really.
Right.
And so people who step away from that are maybe accused of selling out or something. And that's, for us, I don't think that was ever that straightforward, except for, I think it was just people mad at us for putting too many chords in songs, and, you know, not having a banjo or, you know, just not really carrying the tradition that they would have liked to us, of us to do. But there are a lot of great people doing that, and so we didn't really feel any pressure. Plus, we were from California, so by the time we, the bluegrass that we were hearing was already, like, Bluegrass Etc., that band that made the first impression on us, you know, they were playing, like, Beach Boys songs, and Marty Robbins, and Beatles, and, you know, like, the Birds, and things that were not traditional bluegrass. So for us, by the time we heard what we thought was normal bluegrass, it was just the instrumentation, but they showed us that, they gave us a perspective that, you know, these are just the instruments, you can play whatever you want on them.
Right. Yeah, so many country artists over the years have gotten their start in bluegrass from, like, you know, Keith Whitley or Marty Stewart, to even guys like Sturgill Simpson and Chris Stapleton, you know, had bluegrass bands before they got to where they've gotten, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, did you guys have any experience or much experience sort of going through mainstream Nashville?
A tiny bit, but it didn't really suit us. We accidentally, well, it probably wasn't an accident. Somebody probably worked really hard to get this, but on our first record, which came out probably, I think, 2000, there was a song called When You Come Back Down that we sang, and another one called Lighthouse. And When You Come Back Down was played CMT, Country Music Television, was very kind to play a video of that a lot. And it got more exposure. It was a huge amount of exposure for us. That, coupled with Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, coming out a couple years later, was a really good timing.
I mean, did the bluegrass world just go bananas at that point?
Yeah, they were so, it's a huge, and the other thing is, they did such a good job putting that together, the music, I mean, that they got the good stuff, you know, they had Hartford on there, they had John Hartford, they had, you know, the right people heading up T-Bone, and then, you know, I think Gillian Welch had a lot to do with that as well, getting the right sources and getting some great material, the Whites on there, and Norman Blake, so the CMT, we had the video on CMT, and we started to see a lot of country radio stations parked outside of our shows, like in vans, playing real country radio stuff outside, and our audience changed a lot, and we found that they stopped being the audience that would listen a lot, and they started being an audience that would talk a lot, and so our, say we're playing a bar with 300 people, 150 would be ready to listen, and then the other 150 wanted to hear one or two songs, and until that song happened, they really weren't interested. So audiences kind of started to clash, and we realized that, you know, we kind of would rather not have to try and play over our crowd, and so we tried to pivot away from venues that were kind of set up that way and that would draw that kind of, or would be more inclined to talk, you know. Some venues, you know, they train their audiences to do a thing.
Right.
And if audience is expecting to, like, go to their venue and, like, have a great time and, like, catch up with their friends while a band's playing, that's great, but that's not really the place that we wanted to play.
Plus, then you can skip going to the 7 a.m. radio station interview on show day.
Bonus. Total bonus.
That's always nice. Did you take a lot of lessons growing up? I mean, are you an educated musician?
Not like some.
Because you've played with some heavy hitter people.
I do. It's really incredible. And that's what lessons are now, you know, like playing with those guys. But Dennis Kathlinger was my fiddle teacher growing up, and he wouldn't teach me from scratch, because I took Suzuki lessons for the first couple years to get the foundation. And then he'd teach me how to play solos and things, and then when he wasn't on tour. And there came a time when I was like 10 or 11 when he said he wasn't going to teach me any more solos, but that I was going to have to figure him out, and then he'd help me, you know, strategize him, but that I'd have to compose my own solos, and I really wasn't into that at first. It was like, I don't like this as much, but it was so good for me, and then he, you know, helped me start to learn how to improvise, and...
It seems like that's a big part of the bluegrass tradition.
Yeah, it is, And I went to some fiddle camps growing up that were really fun. Mark O'Connor had this fiddle camp in Nashville for a while. I went to the first two of them when I was like 12 or 13 or 13 and 14. And I met so many friends there and who I still know and love. He had all these great teachers. He had
the
like
beginner level
12
cabin
teachers.
At fiddle camp must be really hard to be in.
it's funny because like for the first day everyone's figuring out like, I don't know, am I beginner, am I intermediate, am I advanced, am I intermediate?
That
I
is
know.
An instrument you cannot fake it on.
Oh man,
at all, no frets.
Well, it was really cool because he had like 12 teachers. Or probably more. A bunch of people just came down from Nashville to hang out. He had like a classical teacher, Paul Peabody. He had Liz Carroll was a classical teacher, our Irish teacher. He had Buddy Spiker, this like Texas fiddle player. A bunch of other people. And then everybody would go from, you know, to have these different styles for the first couple days. And then for the last 3 days, you could camp out wherever you wanted to. Whatever teacher's class you want to. It was so much fun. He'd have dances at nighttime.
Sounds great.
It was really incredible. I remember John Hartford was one of my favorite musicians. Are you familiar with John Hartford?
I'm not. No.
He wrote that song "Gentle"
like
on my mind.
Be.
Well, you know so much. I'm honored to get to turn you on to something. But he wrote the song "Gentle" on my mind that Glenn Campbell did. It's knowing that your door's always open. And he's just this character. I feel like he's kind of cut from the same cloth as like a Roger Miller or something.
Oh, okay.
In how much of his personality comes out in his songs.
Right.
And he would come down and play fiddle. There'd be like this group of like 20 kids around him. And he's like this, you know, 60, 70-year-old man who everyone loves, trying to impress. It was a really great experience, and I've gone to a lot of other fiddle camps and just music camps in the past, and they're always really inspiring, even still, because there's this beautiful community.
I wish you could do that as an adult, you know?
Yeah, I mean...
Where does that exist? That's like how I want to spend my vacation.
It's so great. I mean, I have some friends, these kids, not kids, they're my age, but Tristan and Tashina Claridge, and they're a fiddle player and a cellist, and they have this camp in Big Sur. And it's like 100 people they kind of invite who come to this camp, or maybe it's just like friends of friends, and it's all different instruments. And I was teaching there a few years ago, and there's like a few cellos, some guitar players, banjo player, a bunch of fiddles, some other people are just kind of like hanging out and singing, kids and adults. You teach them songs, and a lot of times it's just like call and response, play a phrase, they play it back, or maybe you're just teaching songs or something else, and it's always really fun because it's just this very positive environment where you get to kind of tap back into that community, which is, it's such a beautiful part.
Playing music with other people.
Yeah, it's everything.
Absolutely 100% the best way to learn. I mean, you can't really learn anything unless you kind of really immerse yourself in it in that way, I feel like.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for like shedding in your room,
right.
Playing along with your favorite records, learning solos, and you know, learning parts, and like stopping every 5 seconds and like rewinding and trying to get it. But then you have to take that and you need to play with people and you need to, you know, go between soloing and accompanying and practice going in and out and adapting and
right.
messing up and messing around. And it's it has to be done with people. For me anyway, to be satisfying, it's that relationship.
Out of all the folks that you've played with over the years, whether it's you know, people like Jackson Browne or you know that Alison Krauss, you know that kind of like established performers that you look up to, or people like Blake Mills that produce your records and all that stuff, who's had the biggest impact on you as a player and as a musician, as an artist?
Man, I mean, I don't know. It kind of changes from stage to stage, you know, these people, you glean what you can when you're with them. Alison Krauss had, she produced our first two Nickel Creek records, and she had a huge impact in so many ways, and really kicked our ass in a lot of ways. She's incredible. And you know, you learn from everyone. Jackson Brown is someone I'm technically an adult, but I want to be like him when I grow up. Like, he is, as far as like musically and songwriting, I think he's fantastic. As a person, he's unbeatable. He's just so generous. Always has this open hand in terms of, you know, lending you gear, or like lending, like giving you advice, or like, you know, I've gotten to tour with him a lot, and he's introduced me. I opened for him, and he came out every night and introduced me generously.
Wow.
Every night.
That's huge.
His band played with me for like most of my set.
With Val?
Val, yeah. Val McCall.
Yeah, he's the best.
And it was great. And we played like half the show with him. Uh-huh. And you know, like seeing, you know, how these people, I just got to tour with Patty Griffin for 7 weeks, and seeing how these people who have had careers spanning decades now, how they treat people, how they run their business, how they work, their relationship with their band and with the audience. There's no right way to do it. Everyone has a different way to do it. And it's really fascinating to see the ins and outs of how people do things. Greg Lease, one of my favorite, you know, favorite pedal steel players and all around musicians here in town. He's someone you stand next to him, and it just feels like, you know, you can just absorb musicianship and taste. And, you know, I was listening to that Merle Haggard interview that you did. And it's a very, like, he seems like, he and Greg seem like they're kind of cut from the same cloth, like just perfect gentlemen in music.
Yeah.
And in what matters to them.
I hired Greg Lease to come play on an album I made a few years ago, and I didn't know him. I just got his number and I called him just because, you know, obviously I'm a fan of his work. Mm-hmm. And half the time he was recording with me, I would just sit there and pick his brain about, yeah, you know, well, what was it like
he's
to see the birds?
He's a great story,
you know, I mean,
teller.
He's, that guy is like, he's
you,
deep.
You ought to have him on here. He told this great story. If you talk to him next time ask him about being the house band for Dolly's 9 to 5 movie release. He told this great story about her. He's great.
Yeah, he's amazing. I wanted to ask you about that, the band or project or whatever you call it, WPA that you guys did.
Oh, yeah.
How did that come about? I mean, talk about a super group. That was just an unbelievable lineup of players in that one.
WPA, Works Progress Administration, is a band that kind of developed off out of this project we did with Glenn Phillips. Sean Watkins, my brother, Chris Thiele, and I with Glenn Phillips. Ethan Johns produced this. We just went to Glenn's house for a weekend, made this Polaroid of a record with Jen Kondos as well, and Rich Claussen. And we just played a bunch of songs, and we never really toured it or anything, not much anyway. And
that's funny that you say that, because when I saw that album come out, I was like, how are you ever going to afford to take that band on tour?
Well, yeah,
that's the craziest.
I know. Well, it started with Mutual Admiration Society, this weekend Polaroid project, and then a couple years later we did this Mutual Admiration Society, or WPA.
Right.
And it is untourable. It's that was like even more untourable, because it was Pete Thomas on drums,
yeah,
Davey Farragher playing bass, our
Ben
friend
Mont.
Luke Benmont Tench,
yeah,
Luke Bulla, our friend playing fiddle and guitar and singing, my brother Sean Watkins, and I. Am I missing anybody?
Greg
I think
Lease.
That's it. Greg Lease,
Lease,
of course.
Yeah.
So it's just like, and we recorded it outside of town here in LA, and it was so fun. It was really, 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 it kind of came out of the Largo scene, I guess,
right,
you know, and Family Hour kind of style of collaboration. And we did some shows for it, but it was, a really, you know, it's kind of hard to coordinate your schedule with like Elvis Costello's schedule.
Exactly.
Which is, you know, where Pete and Davey are usually doing when
they're not the busiest group of musicians in LA. Yeah. And we'll make an album with them.
It was so badass. That was so fun.
How come, where'd the name, I mean, I know what the name means, but why did you choose that? I always wondered if there was, if that had a political meaning to you guys. It definitely does to me, but.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's the reference. I think we struggled with a title for a long time, and Glenn came up with that. You know, it was kind of like an all-for-one kind of vibe in that band, I think. You know, and just all hands on deck.
Right.
I think that's, you know, more than anything, where it came from.
Cool. So what's next for you? Your album comes out in July, and then are you hitting the road?
Album comes out in July, and I'm going to start touring probably in June, doing some festivals and some pre-release shows. And then...
The big wind-up.
And then we'll be hitting the road and touring. I'm going to tour as a trio.
Oh, nice.
And we're going to be as many places as possible.
Do you like touring?
I do like touring. I really love doing the shows. I love...
It's the other 23 hours a day that
being
get tedious.
In town. Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, all of us, you know, there was a while there where, like, just stepping into a 15-passenger van made my back ache because of just all the physical memories.
Now you have Sprinter vans. Come to America.
I know. I'm really excited to get out and play these songs for people.
Right.
And let them come to life in a way. Because I didn't really perform these songs live at all before recording them,
right.
Which was different for me. Usually I'd try things out on the road and kind of test them and develop them. But I really didn't want to do that this time. I wanted to have something new for people. And so the first time playing them with a group of people was when we were recording them. And now we've been rehearsing and like kind of working them into a trio setup. I've got my little like Flintstone feet running, ready to kind of hit the ground and get into the rooms.
Well, on that end, would you like to play a song now?
I would like to play a song.
Public. And thank you for coming today. Much appreciated. I'm sure you're running around like crazy.
No, I'm very happy to be here. Okay, I'm going to do this one while I tune up here. I had this tradition that developed for a few years. On New Year's Day, you know, sometimes if you have a few drinks, you wake up real early in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
Feeling great. Like, I like... Like you kind of beat, you kind of, you probably shouldn't feel so bright and sunny, but somehow, like, sometimes it works.
Sometimes if you get up real early, you're still drunk.
Well, that's true. That was not the case this time. I woke up, I spent the night at my friend's house, woke up, everyone was still sleeping, and I just hit the road, and I love to drive. I just started driving, and I ended up out in the desert a little bit, which is a real sentimental place. We used to go camping out there when I was a kid, I left my friend's house and just started driving out to the desert, and it was just great. You know, the streets were empty. It felt like I felt like I was night skiing. Just like I could have swerved all of it. It was great. Just have the roads to yourself. And I just went out there, that became a tradition. It's just really beautiful way to start the year for me. It's usually really beautiful, clear skies out here on New Year's Day, and so. This song is sort of about that, about places that are special and people who are special even after time's passed, and still kind of like this monument in your mind. Damn it. quiet night, driving out to Harriet's again to breathe the air and soothe my mind. A stranger might get lost out in the emptiness if he don't know how to read the signs. Harriet isn't there, I'll let myself in. 'Cause when she's gone for a while. I'll stay a couple days. This is just a little trip to get out from under the pile. This place has got a hold on me, it's got a hold on me. This place has got a hold on me, it's got a hold on. Ooh. The desert will remind you who you ought to be, and it'll show you who you are. There's nothing to protect you or what you're hiding. Now I remember when she found my mark. This place has got a hold on me, it's got a hold on. This place has got a hold on me, it's got a hold on. In the starlight, there are those I held on to and let go. But this one's got a hold on me, she's got a hold on. This one's got a hold on me, she's got a hold. California still fast asleep. Dawn is in my mirror once again, and light begins to
passed the audition. Thank you so much. That's so good.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Amazing, right? That was Sarah Watkins singing a beautiful song from her new record, Young in All the Wrong Ways, called Like New Year's Day. Make sure you go to sarahwatkins.com to see what she's up to. I know she's out on the road, I think, like most of this year, so you can probably find her tour dates there and go check her out live. That's that. For this week, We'll see you in a couple weeks. Our next episode is going to be none other than Jason Isbell. So check back in a couple weeks, and we will have that posted for you. All right, everybody. Adios, amigos. The heart, the thought.